Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
There are lots of things I'd rather read about than do. Climb Mount Everest, for example, or sail across the Atlantic Ocean, or any ocean, or even a big lake. I'd put riding a motorcycle 1,000 miles in a day in that category, too, especially after reading The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing, subtitled Long Distance Motorcycling's Endless Road. Actually, 1,000 miles in a day isn't much more than a warm-up for John Ryan, the aforementioned man who would stop at nothing, the author who tells Mr. Ryan's story, and the stories of various other long rides and riders in The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing is Melissa Holbrook Pearson. When I had the opportunity to talk with her about the new book, I began by asking Melissa Pearson to tell me what sets John Ryan apart from all the other long-distance riders.
Well, like so many adventurers in our history, like Sir Edmund Hillary, he's a person who can't say no to a challenge. He doesn't want to say no. In fact, I think it's what defines him. I think he sets himself apart by sort of mischievously thumbing his nose at the rest of us who need things like sleep, and you know, we want to eat actual hot meals, you know, things like that.
He has no interest in these things.
Absolutely no interest. This is a man who, when he needs to, will tear open a packet of salmon with his teeth and eat it with his fingers.
Presumably while he's still moving.
He, in fact, does keep food in his tank bag, and he's got a straw so that he can hydrate while riding. He's got an enormous gas tank. It's ridiculous. People look at his motorcycle, and for a minute, you see it pass before their eyes. They can't quite grasp what they're seeing.
And the nutritional component of this is complicated by the fact that he's diabetic.
Indeed. I think that might be behind some of his drive. He, I think, might be maybe outrunning the mortality that most of us see coming when you achieve middle age, as he has. So it's both something that propels him and something that could potentially cause him harm.
Melissa, I should mention that you're not writing about long-distance motorcycling from a long distance. You've ridden saddle sores and bun burners yourself, and before we go any further, perhaps you should explain what those terms mean.
Right. A saddle sore is 1,000 miles in 24 hours or less. Mm-hmm. A bun burner is 1,500 miles in 36 hours or less. A Bun Burner Gold, which John Ryan has done 3 back-to-back, is 1,500 miles in under 24 hours.
And you did not take on saddle sores and bun burners just because you wanted to write about what it was like and about the people who did it a lot. Tell us a little bit about the history of your own passion for motorcycles.
I was a rider in the early 80s. And I was just a plain normal vanilla rider. But I stopped riding, like a lot of people do, when other things got in the way, such as family, work, you know, that whole growing up business. And I took a hiatus, and I thought that I had put motorcycles behind me. Well, you know, you really can't do that when they're in your blood. They'll come and find you. And 11 years later, something happened in my life that caused a bit of a stoppage. And for a moment there, I didn't know which way to turn. Enter John Ryan. This guy is so persistent, not only in his riding, but in his personality. And he believes that everybody should be on a motorcycle. It's the only way to go. In fact, this is a man who doesn't own a car. He doesn't have a house, a wife, a job. Anyway, he kept after me. He said, you need to be on a motorcycle. And finally, when I ran out of excuses, I said, yeah, I do. He's right. And, you know, I'm never going to look back at this point. So there was a new thing to do, which was ride long distances. When in the early 80s, this was a truly, truly fringe occupation. Only a few crackpots were doing it. But now it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, even though I think a lot of the rest of the world, even the motorcycle world, isn't aware that this is going on in their midst. They keep it pretty quiet, these people.
You speak to one of the risks faced by long-distance motorcyclists when you write, and I'm quoting now, "You're blinking your eyes quickly to stop them from feeling so tired, so much like they want to close, and then you realize you've just seen something that is not there. That's quite a moment." End quote. I imagine it is. What are hallucinating motorcyclists likely to see?
Just about anything. I was misreading signs. Apparently, when you get very tired, you can't make judgments, the kind of judgments you need to make, such as, I need to stop and take a rest. The really advanced motorcyclists who are doing this stuff, though, are amongst the most careful and best riders, I think, on the planet. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm a true amateur, so I had to make a few mistakes as I got into it, and thankfully, they didn't take me down.
Well, one of those mistakes is the only scarier moment that you describe in the book, as far as I'm concerned. You mentioned that you once fell asleep at 75 miles per hour. What made you decide to keep riding after you realized that that had happened?
I think in a word, stupidity. Again, the loss of that kind of judgment that would have said to me, hey, this is not safe. I was entered in a 24-hour rally, and I had already invested 21 hours in riding all over New England. And by the time that that happened to me, I thought, gee, do I want to throw that all away? No, I can keep going, which is where caffeine comes in.
You write about several rallies set up for long-distance motorcyclists who were directed to visit, albeit very briefly, various places. One of those rallies features the locations of America's most notorious crimes. Would you read the paragraph, please, on page 56 that sets the scene for that rally?
Monday morning dawns sunny and warm, ideal for the beginning of an epic both useless and so deeply meaningful it cracks the brain to fathom it, both bold and foolhardy. When these 100 riders, now milling around their motorcycles with anticipation's knuckles white around their guts, leave the parking lot of the Marriott, they will be going to more places than crime scenes spread across the United States of America, which may well be the crime capital of the world. They will be going to elemental places within themselves, elemental places on our anthropological timeline, too, it turns out.
Tell me about elemental places, both internal and external.
This rally, which comprises 11 days and approximately 11,000 miles, tests people in a way that normal life doesn't. I think it causes them to question themselves in a very, very deep way, because at some point they're going to hit the wall. They're going to say, I cannot go on. And most of them are going to say, but I have to. I want to do this for myself to save face, maybe. But also, there's, I think, a certain pleasure in the human being in meeting extreme challenges, and that's what these people do. Apparently, most of them feel that it changes their lives forever.
You talk about extreme challenges, and the book includes mention of lots of records set by long-distance motorcyclists. Which of those records seem most impressive to you?
Well, the ones where people just decide to take off from one coast, ride straight to the other coast, and then back again, basically without stopping. These are purposeless trips, except for maybe a paramount purpose which exists inside. The ride that John Ryan took that you spoke of at the beginning here, to me, is one of the most extraordinary things anybody's ever done.
Please describe that ride for me.
He rode from above the Arctic Circle, Prudhoe Bay, which was icy, wet, rainy. It took him a week just to get to the starting point because his bike would slide down the mountain and, otherwise injure itself. And once he started, he didn't stop for 86 and a half hours, except for approximately 2 hours each day until he reached the farthest south point in the United States, Key West, Florida. And he was determined to bury the record of the previous record holder, and he did so by over 9 hours.
Toward the end of your book, you tell a story that speaks more to community than to the solitary nature of long-distance riding. Tell us how you acquired a particular motorcycle made by Moto Guzzi.
It's really a beautiful story. I think my first book apparently reached some people. That's the perfect vehicle, and I think of it as a Valentine to these sort of strange and cantankerous machines. Unbeknownst to me, those people might have heard through the ether that something had happened to me and I was unhappy and perhaps feeling lost. And they took it upon themselves to buy me the same motorcycle that I had given up so foolishly 11 years before. And when they told me that they were giving me this bike, it was such a stunning moment because most of these people were, in fact, strangers to me. And you know, when your spouse gives you a motorcycle, it's an extraordinary event. But when a group of strangers chips in, some of these people were virtually penniless. Some of them just gave work or advice. And then they presented this motorcycle to me. It felt as though they had really restored my heart as well as my standing in what is now my family.
Now, I don't want to leave the question of what happened to you entirely mysterious. You went through a divorce, and this was what eventually brought you back to motorcycling.
That's right. Isn't that funny? A sundering reconnected me. It was a sort of unpredictable, let us say, event. I wasn't aware it was coming, and when it did, it severed me from a lot that I had expected or known. But then on the other side of it, it gave me this huge gift in terms of coming back to motorcycling, which is incredibly pleasurable on a personal level, and the wider community of motorcyclists who embraced me.
At some point, it occurred to you that, and I'm quoting now, souls are the province of motorcycles alone among machines. How and when did you come to that conclusion?
I think anybody who spends enough time on the road with their motorcycle will feel that way because you realize that there were chances for it to do things to you, both good and bad. And you communicate and you rely on it to a huge degree. And anything that you do that, you're not placing your life in the hands of your computer, but you are your motorcycle.
Melissa Holbrook-Pearson is the author of The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing, Long Distance Motorcycling's Endless Road. The book is published by Norton, and the author joined me from the State University of New York at New Paltz. Melissa, thank you very much for speaking with me.
And thank you.
My conversation with Melissa Holbrook-Pearson about her new book, The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing, will be featured on this week's program. We'll also be following baseball's postseason as the teams eligible for the Fall Classic dwindle down to 4. Having witnessed the excising of pro basketball's preseason as a result of the lockout, we'll have some updated speculation regarding the likelihood that the NBA's regular season will start on time or start at all. I'll be checking in with Helene Elliott for some good hockey talk, the time having arrived for same, and we'll have a story about the reclamation of a river once notorious for catching on fire. Now the Cuyahoga in Cleveland is home to a host of happy oars people. So join us, and remember you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.